Log Talk Radio.
Yeah, I'd like a hot dog all the way, please.
Coming up. Here you go.
Thank you. Ew. What is this?
That's a corn-based hot dog flavored tube-shaped thing. It's almost good. That'll be $4.50.
You know what? No thanks.
If almost good enough isn't good enough for you, why would it be good enough for your pet? Add Kennel Kelp to your furry friend's diet. Sprinkled on your pet's food, Kennel Kelp helps with arthritis pain and stiff joints. It can also reduce shedding, fill in missing areas, and improve their looks. Healthy pets show even more energy and have better attitudes. See results in 4 to 8 weeks. The good news is, Kennel Kelp isn't just for pets. It's good for you, too. Sprinkle it on your cereal, or use it instead of table salt when seasoning your food. Kennel Kelp is the holistic care solution for pets and their people. Safe for dogs, cats, birds, cows, chickens, reptiles, almost anything that walks, flies, or slithers. It's a holistic health solution for humans, too. To learn about their many products, visit KennelKelp.com. Get Kennel Kelp for a happier, healthier life.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another edition of the BH Sales Kennel Kelp Holistic Healing Hour with your host and moderator, me, Grandpa Bill. Some of you, via our invitation, where applicable, my two church mice, Peter and Paul, each and every day. Ubiquitous audience, one and all, however you got here, thank you so much for doing so. Continue paying it forward. We are growing exponentially with your help in doing so. Quickly, my YouTube channel is Grandpa Bill at Bill Holt 8792. Do give us a thumbs up, like us, share us. Where you're comfortable in doing so, please subscribe. It helps the overall cause, one star seed at a time. I'm going to segue right into the show. Soon to welcome for the 9th time, repeat guest, obviously, Byron Athene, wherever you folks are coming in. Going to reference his website and have you do so, please, with all due respect. Make sure you do check out ByronAthene.com, the website in its entirety for sure, but make sure to highlight the About Us page so you can get familiar or re-familiar with his very impressive background, over 30 years and counting in the business. So tonight's show is entitled Unlocking Happiness with Stoicism. For those of you that may have heard the Prelude shows, did a couple of them, or if you haven't, if you have the opportunity to do so, feel free to go back. We're going to expand upon two questions here geared to yourselves in the listening audience quickly here in the description to repeat them. Have you ever encountered Stoicism or similar philosophies? If so, what aspects resonate most with you? And what are some of the biggest challenges you face in maintaining emotional well-being? And do you think Stoic principles could be helpful? All due respect, wherever you are on familiarity or lack thereof, just you can definitely frame the question any way you see fit. Please do so at the message board at the show. And in a moment, I'll have maybe Byron expand on those two questions. He certainly qualifies for obviously changing the framing of the question when he puts it in the first person. But maybe that's a good place to start. We'll be here for about 45 minutes today. And I have a whole host of questions for Byron when he has a moment to reintroduce himself. Welcome, Byron. Thanks for being here again tonight. Welcome back.
Well, thanks, Bill. It's as always, it's great to be here, appearance number 9. It's, yeah, great to be here once again. Okay, so shall I just jump in?
I was going to let you go right into Stoicism. And I, again, real quickly, anybody that hasn't heard the Prelude shows, you know, Byron's going to bring it all home here momentarily, but do check the Prelude shows as well. And hopefully those are serving as stepping stones for you listeners, you know, as to what we're about to talk about. So, yeah, take it away on Stoicism and happiness, Byron, please.
Okay. Well, actually, first, let me explain the link to myself and Stoicism and the suggestion that we speak about Stoicism today. Because the last appearance, number 8, was me talking about the A, B, and Z mindsets. And so I thought, well, I could go into more detail. I realized by going into more detail, about the true origin of it, and the true origin is Stoicism. So I thought, well, it would be a good idea to explain what Stoicism is, to describe the impact it's had on psychotherapy, especially one of my favorite approaches, which is rational emotive behavior therapy, and then I could describe a framework that REBT uses. I can then describe how I adapted a framework, and then the A, B, and Z mindsets are an extension of that. So let me jump in by just briefly summarizing Stoicism. So it's an early Greek philosophy. Early Greek philosophy. It started around 3rd century BC. And one of the main principles is that we should all, as much as possible, be living virtuous lives and should be at all times maximizing positive emotions and minimizing negative emotions. So it aimed to create a framework to do this automatically. And it was one of the first philosophies that explicitly identified the idea of emotional responsibility. Now, there are two types of emotional responsibility, or two principles. There's a general principle and a specific principle. The general principle is that we are responsible for how we think, feel, and behave. That's in contrast to the belief that our feelings are forced upon us by the situations that we find ourselves in. So we are responsible for how we think, feel, and behave. That's the general principle. The specific principle is we feel the way we do because of the beliefs we hold. So our emotions stem from our beliefs. Now, the Stoics highlighted the importance of rational thinking, so trying to maintain rational beliefs and thoughts at all times, because irrational thoughts and beliefs are not going to help us, and they're untrue. So famous Stoics were Marcus Aurelius, Seneca, and Epictetus. And I think that's almost a testament of the vast range or the scope that Stoicism covered, because Marcus Aurelius was a Roman emperor and Epictetus was a slave. So the fact that a slave and a Roman emperor could adopt the same philosophy, I think speaks volumes about that philosophy. It's applicable for anyone, any walk of life. It's just a sensible, a more sensible way to look at life and existence. So it was used by psychoanalyst Albert Ellis to create a new type of therapy called rational emotive behavior therapy in the 1950s. Now, rational emotive behavior therapy was an answer to the approaches that existed. And at the time, the only two approaches that existed were psychoanalysis and behaviorism. Now, he realized that psychoanalysis focuses on childhood experiences or past experiences and unconscious processes. Behaviorism focuses on conditioning, the classical conditioning and operant conditioning that we spoke about in another show. Now, these two approaches are important, and those three facets are very important: past experiences, unconscious processes, conditioned responses. But Albert Ellis believed that there was something missing. We weren't quite getting to grips with people's issues because we were just missing. We weren't taking into account something really important. And he realized that important thing was the way we think about things, because it's our past experiences matter. Obviously, our unconscious processes matter, our conditioned responses matter, but he believed what matters most is the way we think about things. And there's one of the more famous Stoic philosophers, Epictetus. He has a quote that sums up the REBT or CBT approach. And that quote is, or the start of it is, it's like a whole paragraph, but I'll just say the first line from it. That quote is, "People are disturbed not by things, but by the views which they take of things." So it's not what happens that upsets us, but it's our opinion. So events in themselves aren't disturbing, but our opinions about those events can be extremely disturbing. So what Albert Ellis did was pretty much make a contemporary version of Stoicism, because REBT is just Stoicism updated from what I can tell. So he created a framework that made Stoicism more palatable or more digestible, and he called it the ABC model, which I'll describe for you. So the ABC model, A stands for activating event, any event in the past, present, or future, real or imagined. So any trigger of any type, that's the A. B stands for beliefs. C stands for consequences. Consequences include emotions, behavior, thoughts, and symptoms. Now, Ellis noted that most people have an A to C way of thinking, that they think the events prompt the consequences. So the unfolding of event will make you think a certain way, or make you feel a certain way, or prompt certain symptoms. But that's not the case. The A doesn't prompt that. It's the belief about the A that does. So he used this ABC model to really enable us to see how much power we have in understanding our situations better, and to maximize the agency and power we have no matter what situation that we're in. Because we're sometimes not going to be able to control the A. We're not going to be able to control the event, but we always have control over how we interpret the event, and that's where our emotions and behavior comes from. It's through the interpretation, not the event. And some people disagree with that. Some people, I say that to some clients, and I can see by the looks on their faces, they're not quite right taking it on board. So I say, well, that's clearly demonstrated, just considering the fact that four people could experience the exact same events, but feel four completely different emotions. So that I think indicates that our emotions are perspective driven as opposed to events driven. If our emotions were events driven, all four people experiencing the same event would feel the exact same emotion. The fact that those four people are experiencing four different emotions proves that our emotions are perspective driven, and they are entertaining four different perspectives. So the ABC model is a handy way of just reminding yourself that you are actually removed from the event, and you are only interpreting the event, as opposed to being forced to feel one way or another. Now, okay, I'll just say one more thing before I hand it back over to Bill to ask a question. So, okay, so yeah, I'll get into more detail a bit later. So I adapted the ABC model, and I created a very similar model, but it's streamlined. So I created something called the ACE framework, A-C-E. I think I may have mentioned this in one of my other shows, but I'll talk about it again, because I think it's very important. And again, it shows us that we are in more control of our experiences than we usually tend to believe. So the A in the ACE framework, the A stands for the same thing. So activate an event, any event in the past, present, or future, real or imagined. C stands for concept. So when events happen, when reality takes place, at the moment it happens, it's meaningless until we tell ourselves a story or narrative about it. That story or narrative can be boiled down to a concept or core idea. That's what the C stands for. E stands for emotion. So rather than talk about consequences, which includes emotions, behavior, thoughts, symptoms, I thought, well, let me just focus on the emotional aspect, because I think that's the most important one. So most people have an A to E way of thinking. They think events prompt emotions, but that's not the case. It's the story we tell ourselves. It's the narrative we generate. It's the interpretation we have. It's the perspective we hold. So if you take this on board, then you're not going to be as easily disturbed just because one thing happens. You'll have the understanding that if you're disturbed, you're being disturbed by your belief about the event, or the concept, or the narrative, or the perspective, and that's something that you can do something about.
I just wanted to make sure I gave you ample time. I have a real quick question, with no really particular order of them as we go along in the rest of the show, but one that struck me, and you kind of already skimmed the surface on that, but maybe let me frame it this way, and I love one of your suggestions on that. I'll highlight that. The question itself, I guess, would be, can you differentiate the healthy counterparts to the emotions that Ellis particularly highlighted so eloquently? But like one of your examples is depression against sadness, And yeah. If you want to give some more of those examples, I think that will edify all of us, no matter what our degree of familiarity is or
sure.
isn't. Yeah.
Sure. Okay. So Albert Ellis, according to REBT, there are only 16 base negative emotions. Like studies have been shown, and people have said, "Oh, well, surely there's more." But the studies show that all of the other emotions can be boiled down to these 16. So there's just 16. There are 8 unhealthy negative emotions and 8 healthy counterparts. So the 8. I'll go through the 8 unhealthy and healthy counterparts, just to not make this confusing. So yeah, like as you said, the first unhealthy one is depression. The healthy counterpart is sadness. I'll just pause here for a sec to distinguish between the unhealthy and healthy. So the unhealthy negative emotion is often regarded or referred to as a stuck emotion. So if you're depressed, if you're experiencing that stuck emotion of depression, you're much more likely to remain in that emotion rather than feel resourceful and do whatever you need to do to lift the depression. But if you're experiencing the healthier counterparts, the healthy negative emotion of sadness, you're much more likely to have access to resources. So you're more likely to do something to lift the sadness. You're more likely to maybe listen to music or go out for a walk or talk to a friend, the kind of thing that you would do that you probably wouldn't want to do if you're depressed. If you're depressed, you have really low motivation. You're not feeling at your most resourceful, for sure. I guess that's a euphemism. I know some people's depressions are really, really, really bleak, but that's a stuck emotion. So okay, so the other unhealthy negative emotions and the healthy counterparts are anger and frustration. So again, if you respond to someone with anger, that's a stuck emotion, so you're much more likely to remain angry rather than look at the situation in a more resourceful way and resolve the situation more easily. But if you are frustrated instead, which is the healthier counterpart, you're much more likely to resolve the situation. So then there's hurt, which is the unhealthy negative, and disappointment, which is the healthy counterpart. There's anxiety and concern or worry. Anxiety and concern or worry can definitely be shown to demonstrate the whole stuck thing. Because if you're feeling anxiety, your anxiety is prompted by a perception of threat. But if you're feeling anxious, you're more likely to avoid the thing that's prompting the anxiety. And one of the aspects of anxiety is you're overestimating the level of threat or underestimating your ability to cope. So the fact that you're avoiding the thing, you're not giving yourself the experience of knowing that you're overestimating the threat. In your head, it's an 8 out of 10 threat, but in reality, it's only a 2 out of 10 threat. The fact that you're avoiding the thing means that you're not going to realize, you're not going to experience the fact it's only a 2 out of 10 threat. But if you're experiencing the healthier counterpart, so the healthier negative emotion, concern or worry, you're more likely to ask yourself, well, what am I concerned or worried about, and what can I do to address the concern or worry? So then there's shame, the unhealthy, and then regret, the healthy, is guilt and remorse. And then there's unhealthy envy and healthy envy and unhealthy jealousy and healthy jealousy.
I think that answers it perfectly. And those of you that might have heard the Prelude shows, and I think maybe even one of my blogs, y'all know my memory, and maybe even my social media, but in any event, at least one of those venues, I actually talked a little bit there about negative emotions and a theory called flexible preferences. Maybe that's a good next question, if you want to go kind of tie in flexible preferences.
Oh, sure. Okay. So, yeah. So the unhealthy negative emotions are accessed through rigid demands. So a rigid demand is you thinking that something must happen, or something should happen, or something needs to happen. So if that thing happens, if your demand is met, then yeah, great. But if your demand is not met, it's going to feel like a universal law has been broken, and you're likely to be disturbed. And then one of the 8 unhealthy negative emotions is going to be accessed, depending on the situation. But if you have a flexible preference instead, so a flexible preference is you thinking that, well, I would like this thing to happen, but I accept that it might not, or I would like this thing to happen, but it doesn't have to. If it happens, again, great. If it doesn't happen, you might be upset, you might be sad, but you're not going to be disturbed. So that's one of the distinctions that Albert Ellis made. You're going to be in a much better position if you have a flexible preference rather than a rigid demand. And a flexible preference is more true as well, because a rigid demand is a false belief. Because even though you want something to happen, even though you think you need something to happen, it's not true that it needs to happen. It's just something that you want to happen. Whereas a flexible preference, that's a more true belief. It's more true to say that you would rather something happen, but you accept that it might not. So yeah, this is just another way of ensuring that your beliefs are more rational, more truthful, more realistic. And if you hold on to more rational, healthy, realistic beliefs, your emotions will be managed easier.
Thank you. And I guess maybe we should have started out with this one, but there's no particular order. And I think you probably did a really good job already on this one, but sometimes redundancy is pretty good. So I guess it's kind of framed a little different on something you've kind of already talked about. But anyway, can you maybe revisit, and you pretty much just did, the concept of unhealthy versus healthy and negative emotions, but maybe, again, with no client privileges, you know, all due respect, but what are you finding all of those categories to be pretty prevalent within, you know, your client mix, all of those emotions at some given point where this is an issue for them, if that question makes sense?
Yeah. Well, I would say most of these emotions, I don't deal with unhealthy envy or unhealthy jealousy as much as the other ones, I guess.
Okay,
but
that's yeah. Actually quite good to hear. Yeah, thank you. Continue.
Yeah, no. Anxiety is definitely one of the main ones. You know, I think it's now well known that anxiety and depression are probably the two most common things that people present when they come to therapy. So it's relatively easily resolved if you apply rational thinking. The problem is that someone wants to stick with their rigid thinking. So if you try to introduce rational thinking, there's something that they're probably not going to like jive with, because they want to hold on to their rigid beliefs. So I mean, that's the downside of having a rigid belief. It's rigid for a reason, so it's going to be easier to hold on to it than to let go. So it's a case of helping someone understand that rigid belief, although it might be demonstrated passion, it's not serving you as well as you think it is.
Okay, we have plenty of ample time, so we have a good ample 20 minutes or so. So did you want to segue back in, and I'll kind of have maybe a couple more questions for whatever you want to go, wherever you want to go next, in the next logical progression, you know, to however you want to go next, and I'll jot down some notes, and I'm sure I'll come up with something for you.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, like I said, I wanted to like talk about this today because I realized that the whole ABZ mindset is pretty much an evolution of Stoicism, and it's the AB mindset is a rational belief, but the Z mindset is an irrational belief, in terms of you saying that you need something to be happy. That's irrational. That's irrational for a number of different reasons that I highlighted in the in the last show. I could go over those reasons again, but you You saying you need something to be happy doesn't make sense, because needs are in the realm of comfort. Like wants are in the realm of desires, or happiness is in the realm of desires. So you saying you need something to be happy doesn't even make sense. Also, the neurophysiological effects of a need are different to the neurophysiological effects of a desire. So people, I'm sure a lot of people think, or they need to frame it as a need, or they're benefiting from framing their desire as a need, because then that demonstrates passion, that demonstrates commitment. But that passion and commitment is often counterproductive because of the physiological effects. If you say you believe it or not, if you say you want something, if you believe you want something, you are more likely to get that thing than if you say you need something. You're less likely to get that thing, because when you say you need something, you're more likely to put pressure on yourself to get that thing, and that pressure could be very counterproductive. So you could be getting in your own way. So ironically enough, if you merely say you want something, you're more likely to get it. If you think you need something, you're less likely to get it. So that's another way that the Zen mindset is irrational. Another way it's irrational is it didn't start with Z. It started with B. You had A. You were happy because you had A. You thought, well, I'll be A used to be enough, but it's not enough anymore, so I need B to be happy. So then you get B, maybe you're happy. You think, oh, I'm happy because I've got A and B. And then you get complacent. You get bored, maybe. You see C, and then think, well, I need C to be happy. And then that continues. That continues all the way until you get to Z. So if we were more observant, we would have caught this unhelpful pattern by the time you got to F or G. We would have said, oh, I need G to be happy. Well, hold on, I thought that about B, C, D, E, and F, but it wasn't true then. Why do I think it's true now? But we don't catch ourselves on the way, so we make it all the way to Z, and we wholeheartedly believe that we need Z to be happy. But the times we get Z, we're happy for a while, but then Z becomes incorporated into or part of the A to Y, which means that leaves room for another Z. That means with a Z mindset, you're probably never going to be truly happy. So it makes more sense to adopt a AB mindset, which is to base your happiness on something that you have and that you always have. That means you're always going to be happy. The B is just going to be a bonus. It's the way I sometimes say it to my clients, that having the A is almost like having £1 million or $1 million. B is like having an additional $1,000 or pounds. If you don't have the B, you're not going to care because you're a millionaire. But the Z mindset is forgetting that you have the million pounds or $1 million. You thinking about that additional thousand, and so you think, well, you need that thousand because you're not thinking about what you already have. So if you don't have the thousand, then you can be upset that you don't have the thousand, as opposed to thinking, well, I don't need the thousand because I've already got a million.
It's fascinating, and a little inside joke. Definitely in one of the prelude shows, I kept mispronouncing, which I have a propensity to do with my own name. So our friend Byron will chuckle. E picked Tetis, if you will. I'm gonna call him the Big E. If you want, all kidding aside, if you want to expand upon himself, because I quote him a lot. And he's not necessarily known as a poet, because he never was really a designated poet, but he's had some fascinating quotes. Obviously, one that Byron already quoted on. But if you want to go a little bit further about other Stoics, I think that might be great, just for the histrionics, to tie it in, to broaden the history of it a little more, if you want to go that route.
Yeah, so yeah, as I mentioned, there's Marcus Aurelius, possibly the most famous one, because he was a Roman emperor. Then there's Seneca as well, which is another one of the classics. There's Zeno, I believe, is another one. But these, I think, one of the good things about the Stoics is like you can almost swap quotes. They were so consistent with what they said, whereas other other philosophical approaches. One person saying something, even though they follow a certain tenet, it could sound quite different to another person who's on the same bus. Whereas Stoicism, it seems all like interchangeable. It's all very rational. It's all very logical stuff. And I think maybe some people don't. It doesn't quite gel with some people, because I think there's still a common misconception that people are either rational or emotional or emotional or logical. But I don't think that's the case. I don't think we are able to separate logic from emotion. Every single emotion we feel, we have a very good logical reason to feel that emotion, we would feel another emotion that we think better fits the situation. So trying to be as rational or logical as possible could be everyone's pursuit, because then their emotions will be better regulated. That's my view anyway.
That's great. I was just scanning some of his other quotes. And there are so many. So if this is a redundant one, again, redundancy is good. But I love all of them. But I love the one: happiness and freedom begin with a clear understanding of one thing. Some things are within our control, and some things are not. It is only after we distinguish between the two that we can begin to find peace. I love that one.
Yeah, that's great. That reminds me. I was going to say something in our last show about the Serenity Prayer, because I didn't realize.
You know what? I would love to have you. If you want to take the liberty to go ahead and quote the Serenity Prayer, I'd love to have you do that and talk about it. That'd be
okay,
awesome.
Okay, so yeah, in fact, yeah. Let me find it, because I did make an addition to it. So let me see if I can find the addition.
Please do, and I want your addition. Take your time, and if I need to fill in a little time, you guys are all excited now. You've been forewarned. I'll just fill in while he's reaching for whatever, and speak right up, Byron, when you're ready to go.
Sure. But okay. Yeah.
Are you ready, or you still need?
No. Just I'll find it. I'll let you know when.
Okay. Yeah. No problem. So I'm just gonna chatter along a little tiny bit. So those of you that might have heard a couple of the Prelude shows, and I really hope you do, let me know that as well at the message board. We're really, really trying to get your interaction. And you guys and gals are doing a great job as far as the support. This is by no way, shape, or form a complaint. You guys are doing wonderful in helping spreading the message. But we do really want to make sure that we're staying fresh and, you know, covering the issues that might concern yourself. And, you know, whatever your comfort zone is, you can do it anonymously or whatever. We're all friends here. It's nothing like that, if that's, you know, what might make you a little hesitant or something like that. But please do reach out. It helps the themes that, you know, we can stay maybe a little bit more on course with what folks are actually looking for. And Byron will refresh us when he gets back to do so. He's always extended the offer to, for sure, reach out to him directly. And you can do that again at byronathene.com for sure, and his email, which he'll reiterate in a moment when he gets back to do so. Were you indeed still in your search and destroy mission?
No, I found it. I found it. Okay.
Okay,
so,
good.
Yeah, so
take it away.
I think the Serenity Prayer is probably something that lots of people know. They might not know it's called the Serenity Prayer, but I'm sure they'll recognize it when I read it out. So I think
But they haven't had the great pleasure to hear your new addition. So please take it away.
I guess not. They're in for a treat. Okay, let's go. All right. So the original prayer is: grant me the serenity to accept the things I can't change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So that definitely echoes what you just said about control, about only acting upon things that you do have control over, because there's no point in trying to act upon something that you don't have control over. That just sounds like common sense, but we still try. There are things that we don't have control over, and we disturb ourselves, and we really use our agency in a less than ideal way because we're trying to affect a change, and we can't because it's something completely out of our control. So the Serenity Prayer is a helpful reminder to only focus on the things that we can control, and if we need to do something to affect a change, then hopefully we'll have the courage to do the thing that we need to do. So I'll read out the Serenity Prayer again, and I made an addition to it because the Serenity Prayer doesn't take the baby theory into account, the idea that we feel
Correct.
Bad only because we needed to feel bad when we were babies, the prompt mama to intervene and solve the problem. So, okay, here we go. So the original is, grant me the serenity to accept the things, grant me the serenity to accept the things I can't change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So I added, also grant me awareness to realize if I feel bad, there's something I'm not accepting. That means I still want something changed. Grant me insight to identify whether I need to be more serene or more courageous. So hopefully that drives home the point that you may think you're accepting something, but if you're feeling bad, you're clearly not accepting it as much as you could.
That's beautiful, Byron. Was that a recent addition by yourself, or you did that addition quite some time ago?
I did. Well, let's see how old this is now, because it's in my book, and so it's been
and
book
I want to talk
while,
about
but...
your book, by the way. I'm glad you said that. But continue okay. with your thought right now.
Yeah, it's maybe I thought of it about a couple of years ago, maybe.
Okay, that's beautiful. It's so beautiful. And so true. It brings it down to earth. And for those of us that know about the Serenity Prayer for former ghost lives and all of that, God bless all of us. That hits home so much. It really does. It really does. Thank you for that. So why don't you, if you want, I mean, I want to make sure you get everything in this session, but tell us more about the book again for those that, you know, might not be familiar at any level yet about your new book. And again, redundancy for those that are. Where you at? You know, it's only been a week or so due to April, the way it transpired for us. Another little inside joke. We had the pleasure to have Byron twice this month. But yeah, do expand upon the book. And you got a good 8 minutes to do so. So take it away.
Okay. That's fine. Okay, that's more than enough time. I probably can't speak for 8 minutes about it unless I read bits out. But okay, so my book is ultimately describing my therapeutic approach. That's emotion-focused brief therapy. And my therapeutic approach stems from, and this might sound controversial, I'm not sure if I've said this on your show before, I've said it on the other podcast,
sure.
But
sure.
I don't actually believe in therapy. I believe in therapy, but I think therapy could be easily avoided if we had better education.
I agree.
I agree.
And real quickly, I think you did with my crazy memory, but I think you did say that early in our endeavors way back when. But continue.
Okay.
You just said it right now, so that's great.
Yeah.
Continue.
Yeah, so I think if we learned some really fundamental things about the way our minds work, we wouldn't develop issues like anxiety and depression and stress. Those things wouldn't exist because we would be able to better control our emotions because we've been doing it since we were children. But because we weren't taught these really fundamental ways that fundamental things about the ways our brains worked, we grow up, we develop issues, and so then we seek therapy to resolve these issues, and it's only as effective, it's effective if the therapist is skillful enough and if the client is receptive enough. But it could have been easily avoided if this was taught in schools. But yeah, it's not, so therapy is needed. So,
that's awesome.
Okay.
I'm sorry, if you had more, I wanted to make sure I wasn't cutting you off there.
So I was just going to just give you a quick summary of the book. It starts off with like a really quick history of psychotherapy. So it goes through the first key approaches like psychoanalysis and behaviorism and rational emotive behavior therapy. Then it then talks about what I've done, and I brought in a few approaches because therapy hasn't really changed much in the last however long. I mean, REBT was developed in 1955, and you could have a therapy session that was almost identical in structure and content to a session that took place in 1955. So I don't think therapy has changed that much So when I introduced the baby theory, I realized that I could change therapy, because if people understood the baby theory, then they would just be able to have more agency. They'll be able to have a better understanding of that really important subconscious process. So this book really kind of expands upon that. It emphasizes that this idea, and I'm not saying I know it's definitely true. I know 100% I'm saying that of all the theories I've heard, it makes the most sense. And I've been trying to disprove it. I've not been able to. So, and I thought of it for 31 years ago. So I think I'm starting to think it's true. If it wasn't, I would have either disproved it myself, or I would have spoken to someone who was able to disprove it. So I've spoken to like hundreds of people about it now, and no one, I don't think anyone's come close to disproving it, but people have made clear that they don't want to believe it for whatever reason.
Perfectly said. So with a good 4 minutes left, let's make sure that we didn't lose anything in translation. I'm going to let you repeat your particulars with your website and just reinforce that you're always open for folks, not putting words in your mouth. I want you to say that of your own volition, but that folks can indeed reach out to yourself directly. So please do reiterate that for us all. Thank you.
Sure. So what do you want me to say, Bill? No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, just refresh everybody about your website, how to get a hold of you, your email, and if they have any direct questions to facilitate our upcoming 10th show and beyond. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, no, I was just joking. I can joke too. I can give it back. Okay, so yeah, so my website, www.myname.com, ByronAthene.com. My email address, if anyone wants to reach out, is again myname@gmail.com. I'd happily field any questions or just hear any comments. It'd be good to hear from you.
Perfect. And okay, you guys always get a treat today too. We had 3 minutes to spare, but we're going to sign off for today, and Byron and I will actively work behind the scenes in May. Good Lord willing, and the creek don't rise. It's just a little joke. Everything was fine. We'll probably be blessed with Byron for the one visit. He was so gracious to come twice this month. So we got a good double jeopardy when I say that. Very good double jeopardy. So we'll say bye-bye for today, everyone. Make it a safe and productive day whenever you hear this. And always, peace, everybody. Thank you. Bye-bye for now, and may God bless.
Thanks. Bye.